I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. After losing population during the last half of the 20th century, Philadelphia has been experiencing a population boomlet in recent years, with young professionals, artists, and baby boomers moving into the city. They're transforming the neighborhoods that fan out from Center City, including Fairmount, Fishtown, Strawberry Mansion, South Philly, Port Richmond, Brewery Town, the Temple University area, and the Graduate Hospital area. These are neighborhoods that have been home to generations of families, many of them low income. Today on Radio Times, the implications and impacts of gentrification. It can mean displacement and higher property taxes, and it can also lead to neighborhood revitalization and improvement. We have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Let me introduce them to you. Nora Liktash is Executive Director of the Women's Community Revitalization Project. She's also a member of the Philadelphia Coalition for Affordable Communities Steering Committee. The coalition just came out with a report called Development Without Displacement. And Nora, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Also with us is Carolyn Adams, and she's a professor in the Department of Geography and Urban Studies at Temple University, where she teaches courses in urban development, city problems, and government policy. Carolyn, it's been many years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And also with us, Rahim Islam. He's the president and CEO of Universal Companies, and that's a community development and education management company here in Philadelphia, founded by songwriter and activist Kenny Gamble. Rahim Islam, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning.
He said he's going to tell Kenny Gamble he's now described as an activist, which is all good.
Yeah, he is an activist.
Yes, indeed he is. Carolyn, let me begin with you, and it's always kind of boring to begin an interview with a definition, but I want to make sure our listeners and all of us know what it is that we are talking about, because gentrification seems like such a loaded word. How should we understand what it means?
What most people think when they're talking about gentrification, I think, is about rising housing prices. They think about a very rapid rise in housing prices in a neighborhood, usually a neighborhood that had lost some value, where houses are more affordable and could be picked up at a cheap rate, attracting developers to come in and see this as an opportunity for making a profit doing building or rehabilitation. So that feature, the rapidly rising house prices, is always accompanied in gentrification by a kind of changeover in the people who are arriving as newcomers in the neighborhood. And actually, that second feature, the social feature, is sometimes a lot more important to people when they think about gentrification, when they see it happening in their neighborhood.
And I do want to pick up on that. Rahim, why do you think Philadelphia is experiencing such a dramatic increase in gentrification in, let's say, the last 5, 6, 7 years?
Well, it's a really complicated, but it's, you know, it's an economic move, number one.
You can see it, for
yeah,
one thing.
I mean, well, yeah, I think that for the most part, many of these neighborhoods have gone down, and their proximity to, like, really attractive, you know, assets, like your downtown, your health and med, your waterfront, the value's going down so low over a period of time that it become attractive. And this is a national trend happening in almost every urban area in the country. So it's not just Philadelphia. It's pretty much everywhere. So what has happened, these real estate values have suppressed so badly and deteriorated so badly. Again, now they've become, you know, and developers and capitalists are looking for ways to make money and bingo.
There it is.
Yeah.
To you, Nora, and you know, for years it seems the city has been working to attract people back to the city after losing so much population at the last half of the 20th century. I remember doing programs about college graduates. You know, why do they leave Philadelphia? Why don't they stay? Now some of them are staying. How do you see this pretty dramatic change and even this issue of gentrification?
Well, we believe that the city needs development, and development is really important, partly to fund our schools and our other services. But along with development comes this issue of displacement. And so our document is called Development Without Displacement, Keeping Communities Strong. And we believe that displacement of families, of businesses, of open space is a real problem, and we've seen it in our neighborhood.
And affordable housing is a huge problem in Philadelphia, a challenge in many ways. This is a city with a pretty large population of low-income families and individuals. Part of this report says that something like 40% of the population in Philadelphia is paying more than or about 30% or more of their income on housing.
Yeah, people sometimes call that housing cost burden, but what it really means is that people can't afford to pay their housing costs, buy their kids sneaks, keep their lights on. It's a real problem.
Do you see that as well, Frank?
Oh, absolutely. I think that what's masking this kind of economic boom for those who are able to, you know, participate in it is those who have been living in this community for years, and the level of poverty, the high level of poverty, and the number of people either poor, as described by the national standards, or near poor. So we have a lot of people who are poor, near poor, and working poor. And so that really has never been addressed. When we start bucketing like affordable housing, these are ideas and concepts that basically try to address and try to address the disparity. But the reality is that many of these cities haven't been able to figure this thing out.
Right.
In fact, I haven't seen any city has been able to figure it out. And Philadelphia definitely hasn't been able to figure out how do we deal with getting more people with bigger and larger incomes, but yet at the same time not create a more wider divide between those who have and those who don't have. And when you have, you have the power. And when you don't have, you don't have the power. So the powerful get more powerful, and the powerless get more powerless. And so that's what's happening in the city of Philadelphia right now.
Well, let me go back to you, Carolyn, and even going back to this very specific issue of gentrification. And oftentimes what you see is these are low-income areas. People discover them. They buy a house at a really affordable rate. They begin to fix it up. And then the values increase, the rents increase, and you begin to see people, especially renters, it seems to me, that end up getting, what, pushed out of some of these neighborhoods?
Renters are definitely in the most precarious position. There's no question about that. Homeowners in Philadelphia have a couple of ways of getting a little bit of relief from higher taxes, which, of course, turn out to be their biggest problem. When the area gentrifies around them, their property taxes rise as a result of higher assessments of their own properties. So they have a little bit of relief given to them through the city council's adoption of a tax relief program following our AVI, our adjustment of all assessments across the city. And there are other ways that people who live in houses as homeowners, particularly if they're elderly and have lower incomes, they can get some relief. Renters don't really have these kinds of assistance, and that's why affordable rental housing is so important in Philadelphia. And it is, I want to back up something Raheem just said, I think it clearly is an issue of income levels for renters, income levels which are really too low to allow them to afford the units that developers are now building.
I know you and I believe your organization, Nora, are interested in this flip tax. I guess there are speculators that come in, see these neighborhoods, buy houses, fix them up, and then within a year or two, they sell them at obviously a much, much higher cost. How would a flip tax work, and why is that a good thing?
Well, just to take a step back, this affects renters and homeowners, as Carolyn said, but many homeowners are low-income homeowners in Philadelphia, and that means they haven't been able to keep their houses repaired because it costs so much to do that. And so they're very vulnerable to someone coming in and offering them what seems like a lot of money. But that developer, again, can make a much larger profit. So the idea of an anti-speculation tax is something that's been developed by the Philadelphia Coalition for Affordable Communities. And the idea is that on any property. Oh, and another step back is that real estate development that's occurring, market rate development, creates a higher tax base, but it also creates an opportunity to generate resources that could address the problem of displacement. Mm. So that's what this anti-speculation idea is. And the idea is that if a property sells twice within 24 months, that second sale would have an increased realty transfer tax of 1.5%. So it has some data about what's happened. Should I give you the data?
Sure, why not?
Mm-hmm. So in 2013, more than 6,000 real estate transactions in the city were repeat sales, meaning that properties were sold again within 24 months, and the value of those repeat sales totaled $782 million. That's a lot
of
money.
That is a lot.
And that's in realty transfer tax. And that tax is right now 4%. 3% goes to the city, 1% goes to the state. So it generated $782 million for the city and $58 million for the state. And what our researchers have shown that if that 1.5% was added to repeat sales, it could generate $12 million for a city. And we're proposing that it go into the housing trust fund. And that would currently double the housing trust fund. And the housing trust fund creates and preserves affordable housing, helps deal with homelessness, and in our case, we want it also to deal with urban food production.
What do you think of that, Raheem? I mean, should we put speculators in one camp and people that are developers and individual homeowners in another?
You know, I don't know. I mean, obviously, you know, these tools are, you know, helpful, but there's I think we're kind of like, you know, I don't have the answer, but it seems like we kind of, like, you know, chasing our tail here, because what we're trying to mask or address is the massive economic disparities. And those disparities didn't just show up.
Right.
They weren't created yesterday, last week. And so what happens is, why is it such a large population of black people, especially in the urban, that's where the gentrification is taking place. This is really not, you know, in fact, it's the flip. It's where you have black people move into predominantly white neighborhoods, white flight, and then those areas become predominantly black. And then those areas that are left are now open with a massive level of vacancy, a massive level of renters, and then they become prime areas for redevelopment. But so it's not like it's, you know, we're gentrifying pretty much. I mean, there are some poor white communities that are being rebuilt. No question about it. But predominantly, they're in predominantly black neighborhoods. So the question what I would ask, and that's never really been asked, and I wrote a four-part series on urban renewal is really about urban removal. Mm-hmm. Because we have not dealt with the disparity that goes back at least 150 years when black people were coming out of slavery, owned any capital, didn't have any capital, didn't have any wealth. And they've been working behind since then, when it's easy to see the line towards the legacy of wealth and the legacy of wealth. So you have people, you know, that number you just quoted, Nora, is, you know, all those sales and the acquisitions, the capital lines, all that is participating, you know, predominantly poor people and definitely black people are not participating in those numbers because they lack wealth.
Well, let's take a very short break. And Carolyn, I know you want to weigh in on that. We are talking about, you could call it, I guess, urban renewal. Our guest, Raheem Islam, wants to have us think of it as urban renewal, also gentrification. Talking with Nora Liktash and also Carolyn Adams and Raheem Islam. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. We're talking about the fact that Philadelphia is gentrifying at an unprecedented rate, apparently true for a lot of cities in this country. People are moving to cities. And again, our guests are Raheem Islam. He's president and CEO of Universal Companies. Carolyn Adams, professor in the Department of Geography and Urban Studies at Temple University. And Nora Liktash, executive director of the Women's Community Revitalization Project. And we have tweets coming in at WHYY Radio Times. And you can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. Carolyn, you wanted to weigh in. Raheem was talking before the break that in many ways African-American families and people living in the city have borne the brunt of these housing changes.
Yes, and what I wanted to say really is in reaction to comments from both Nora and Raheem, and that is this, that I think the strategies we would be best advised to pursue here in Philadelphia are strategies that try to use market forces for the advantage of low-income and disadvantaged people. We are not going to change the natural market forces in the land market that make people bid more dollars for desirable locations. Raheem was I think, very correctly pointing out that some locations in Philadelphia have undergone this gentrification because they're just very desirable locations. They have some amenities and they have their near jobs and so on. We're not going to be able to fight that. But what's so brilliant about the strategy that Nora was just describing to us is it takes those market forces, that is the turnover of properties in the marketplace, and it extracts some value from those processes on behalf of people who are low income and disadvantaged. That, to me, is the smartest kind of strategy to pursue on this problem.
Nora, let me go back to you, and even going back to this title, Development Without Displacement. Is that, I mean, I see we were talking before the show about Germantown. Whether is that the sort of sole example in Philadelphia, maybe parts of Mount Airy, where you see development without displacement?
I don't think it is the sole area, but any area is ripe for it if you have the amenities that Raheem described. So if it's close to Center City, if it's good public transit, it's close to where you work, that neighborhood is in danger of being gentrified. Neighborhoods that don't have that, it may take longer or not occur. So I think we can only pat ourselves on the back to the degree to which we develop policies that intervene in the market forces in a way that allow us to save those communities. And I think Philadelphia is a city that can do that.
Raheem, do you see any benefit positives from gentrification?
Yeah, of course. There obviously, you know, the economic boom is good. I mean, the city needs revenue. It needs tax revenue. They need a balance of poor and working poor and high-income people. My problem is that it's pretty much disproportionate. So you have the boom right now. The new people coming in are probably 100% white. So there's no wealth being created by black people. And so as a result, you know, again, these disparities are growing. And what's most important to me is that the conversation has been removed. The dialogue about what really is happening and how it happened has been completely removed. So we look at an outcome today as if, you know, this happened yesterday, and that so you have a whole bunch of white people coming and moving into a neighborhood who are very wealthy, or put like this, high income, and some of them are very wealthy because we did some projects and I've never seen that kind of cash that people had. And they look down on the other people because as if those people can't do anything about themselves, or they are, well, you know, this is my neighborhood now and I'm taking over this and I'm going to do this and you people. But the reality is no one's talking about, well, how did they get their wealth and how did they get their poverty? And so that's a discussion that has to be had. And then obviously it's going to be those remedies that Nora talked about, diverting some of the economic gains that and fuel them into ways that we can do more affordable housing. But here's what I say: the cure for cancer is when we could do market rate housing at affordable levels, and so when we can without having public subsidies, and that's where we're pushing towards more being able to do market rate housing at affordable levels.
Carolyn, I know you want to add to what we've been talking about. Go ahead.
Yeah, I want to say that I think part of our problem is a really broad cultural problem in this country. And that problem is we expect to live in neighborhoods surrounded by people who are exactly like us. And we and there's a trigger moment in neighborhoods when a certain number of people move in who don't look like us. And that can be either people who are lower income and lower education than we are, and that triggers fear in the hearts of the residents who are there. It can also be triggered when people who are higher education and higher income. That's a cultural expectation that Americans have that people in other cultures don't necessarily have.
Uniquely ours?
It is much more prominent in the U.S. than in other places. That's partly cultural. It's partly because we see our home as our greatest asset and our investment. We treat it as an investment, and we're so fearful of anything that endangers that investment.
This is more anecdotal, but I mean, I certainly know people that have moved into these more gentrified areas who want to improve the local school there because they want to send their child there. They actually don't want the local people that have lived there for a long time to move out and are trying to sort of figure out how to how to have a diverse community. Does that ring a bell with you, Nora?
So I work in North Philly, east of Broad, and I saw a lot of people moving into the community who appreciated the diversity. The neighborhood where my office had been for 17 years, we got pushed out. We were displaced. My organization had to move out. But that neighborhood initially was African-American and Jewish, more Latinos moved in. And folks came, artists, they say they precursed gentrification, but they needed affordable space. And others who really wanted that diversity. But we need to make sure that we have the intentions and the policies that can really ensure that despite the market, we can create, we can include, I'm sorry, keep that diversity. And that, to me, is around race, and that's predominant, but also around class and culture. And I just want to give some stats to back up Raheem, if that's okay.
Sure, that's okay.
In North Philly, where I work, the African-American population since 2000, so families, has decreased 22%. In South Philly, where Raheem works, it's 29%. And in West Philly, around, you know, Penn, but beyond, it's also 29%. And when you look at the increase in white families, it is predominantly white families. But in those same neighborhoods, you still have a number of people who are low income. Like, income is going down in our city, and even in neighborhoods, income is going down. So that makes it even harder for those of us who have been there who might be displaced to stay.
Where do African families go?
Well, that's a challenge, because what they're doing is, we haven't been able to educate the black community to understand real estate trends and real estate values. So we have black flight, too. And black flight has caused many of these issues. When people romanticize about when we black people were living better in this country, it was pre-segregation. And that's when black families lived together. Unfortunately, we had laws that forced the segregation, and that had to be fought and won. But what happened was, when those laws were removed, you had an exodus of high-income black individuals, and that hasn't stopped. And they've been chasing an assimilation in many cases, wanting to be assimilating, because we've defined success as being near white, close to white, being with white people. Now, I'm giving you some secrets in the black community, so I'm going to share with you some of the secrets that are taking place. And so the challenge for us is to educate the black community that, no, you can have value. You can have everything that you want. In fact, the neighborhoods that we've created, where we've exited, that we've seen now how valuable those neighborhoods are, because now the entire tri-state area now has bombarded the market forces and came into those neighborhoods and taken those neighborhoods over because somebody left those assets. And who left those assets primarily are African-Americans who had some kind of capacity to do what they need to do. But they lack a true understanding of American systems. And so they're following a trend, and those things have cost us dearly.
Carolyn, let me read a tweet from Tony. He says, we need to address the issue of lending practices and redlining to have a full discussion of gentrification.
Absolutely.
Yes, and I think that there really have been two waves of financial transactions in Philadelphia neighborhoods, as there have around the country, that we need to recognize. One is the redlining that Tony is talking about, where financial institutions, lenders, have been unwilling to lend money to prospective buyers trying to buy into particular neighborhoods. And this has very significantly over time affected the viability of some of our inner city markets, African-American markets.
Suppressed them completely.
Yes. And then the second wave, of course, was this wave of predatory lending that went through in the 2000s, where some of those same neighborhoods that had been coming back now were awash in bad loans.
Debt, right.
And that, when those came to foreclosure, that also suppressed value in the neighborhood. And, of course, all of this reflects the fact that in our real estate markets, your own house value, no matter how good your own house is severely affected by the values of homes around you. So you're constantly worried about what is going on in the area around you simply because your own value depends so heavily on that. And both of those real disasters, financial disasters in redlining and also in predatory lending, have really damaged the values in neighborhoods around Philadelphia.
Let me just quickly reintroduce everybody. That's Carolyn Adams, also with us, Raheen Islam, and Nora Lichtash. And we are talking about gentrification in Philadelphia. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And as Tony did, you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Nora, there's a project, I believe, in Germantown for affordable housing that's underway, or at least in the blueprint stage?
Yeah, so it's been very difficult for us to acquire land in the neighborhood that we've worked for 28 years, where we've developed about 250 units of affordable housing. So Germantown has a lot of vacant land and is a great neighborhood. I've lived there for 44 years, and my organization has, with the Planning Commission, identified a site on Worcester Street. We call it a site, but it's a place to build.
Okay.
And it's east of Germantown Avenue, and we're proposing to build 35 units of affordable housing. The idea is that this would be rental housing for a compliance period and then turn into home ownership. So the funders make us keep it rental for a certain period of time. The land is owned by a community land trust, and these homes will always stay affordable but become home ownership.
And what's been the response from the neighborhood? I realize this is at the beginning stages.
Sure. So we have more than 300 people who have signed petitions in support. I have never developed any kind of housing development or even facility for childcare where there hasn't been some opposition, and there has been some opposition. But I think it's based on some stereotypes of who is going to be living around you. So for the reasons Caroline just raised, that people who rent are not as good as people who own.
And what is affordable housing in Philadelphia? I mean, what does that mean, Raheem?
Well, it means basically that, you know, either two ways, either you write down the cost of either the for sale or the rent through public subsidies. So you make it, there's an average area median income that basically is considered affordable. It takes the aggregate income and does a median. Right. And 100% of median, I think, for a family of four might be like $60,000 a year for a family of four. I'm not sure exactly. Is it
in Philly? It's about $37,000 for a family of four, but in the area median income, it's almost $80,000.
Okay, so that's a disparity right there that mm-hmm. you're describing. So basically, it attempts to either give the individual renter or a home buyer a subsidy to write down the cost of their housing, or it gives a developer subsidies to write down the cost of construction, so they can pass those savings on to the renter or to the buyer. Here's the last. I think again, the last real massive level of affordable housing development took place in the 30s and 40s and 50s with public housing. And I'm not suggesting a public housing approach, but I am suggesting a federal approach to deal with this issue. And we haven't had any real capacity coming from the federal level. The dollars that are being put on the table today is not enough to do any kind of scale. I mean, so Nora does 35. I mean, really 35, and then maybe we do 50 or whatever. You're not moving the needle with that kind of scale. So there has to be master planning, master development. There has to be a participation with the city, the state, and the federal government to move these kind of things. In addition to capitalizing off the new income that's coming into the city, and having right now, there's a real big issue around tax rebates, and the rebates that very wealthy people are getting to make even more money. Is that fair? I don't have the answer, because I'm pro-development, so I don't want to slow down development at any cost. But at the same time, I want to see that development more equitable. And there's some tools need to be created or perfected that does not exist in order for that to happen. The private market cannot sustain itself in this environment, and it's creating, again, a wider gap. And Philadelphia will look completely different in the next 10 to 15 years. Unless something's done right now, you'll have very rich white people and extremely level poor black and brown people.
Karen, let me go back to you. And I was also reading about something called the Healthy Row House Project. I mean, is there money that low-income homeowners can use to stay in their homes, maybe fix up their homes so that they, you know, don't have to deal with some of this deteriorating housing stock.
Yes, I think that such funds are available and have been available actually for a long time, both from the city and the state. But it's not enough, and also it's not well enough known. So many homeowners have no idea that such help is available, and the messages aren't getting to them. And so unless you have organizers in a neighborhood who are really making this kind of aid known to the local homeowners, there is a disconnect between those. I did want to take an opportunity, since we have two incredibly knowledgeable and successful developers at this table, to ask both of you this question. Do you think that the land banks that has been created in Philadelphia in the recent past, does that have any promise for both of you in terms of trying to find opportunities for the development at scale, Raheem, that you were just talking about a minute ago, that would be necessary to assemble parcels for development at scale?
Without question.
And about a minute before our break, but go ahead.
Well,
it's
definitely one of the tools that you need to have on your side. But you have to have an administration that understands it. You know, you have to have a public officials who get this, you know, because, you know, we can make gains in 4 years and then another administration come in and all the gains you made are going out the window. So it's not linear. And that's why we've been pushing for organizing, because, you know, you just said it, you know, we could build all day long. But if we don't organize the different pockets of people, including the black community, the brown community and the white community, to understand, we're never going to move this needle. And That's something that we kind of underestimated. We were transactional organizers. Now we're kind of permanent organizers.
Well, hold on to that thought, Nora, because I know you want to weigh in on that as well. But we are up against the clock here, and we need to take a very short break. That's Raheem Islam. He's president and CEO of Universal Companies. That's a community development and education management company here in Philadelphia. Carolyn Adams, a professor in the Department of Geography and Urban Studies at Temple University. And Nora Liktash, she's executive director of the Women's Community Revitalization Project. We are talking about gentrification in Philadelphia. Join us at 1-888-477-9499. And stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, having at least as interesting conversation off the air with my guests as we are on the air. And we got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. But, Nora, I want to go to you and give you a chance to weigh in on this land bank issue that Carolyn had raised.
Yeah, I just want to say I'm on the board of the Philadelphia Land Bank. And the reason I am on the board is because of very strong organizing on the part of the Campaign to Take Back Vacant Land, which was the precursor to Philadelphia Coalition for Affordable Communities. And we ensured that that land bank had teeth to make sure that land got out not just for market rate, which we support, but also for affordable uses. But I want to say that tools are just tools. And so it goes back to what I think all of us are saying. Those tools are critical, but people need to know about them. And then there needs to be people power to ensure that the right tools get in place in the right way and that our elected officials are accountable to us in enforcing and making those tools of good use. And so that people power piece that Raheem brought up is just critical in all this. And I want to say, if there's anyone out there that wants to join the Coalition for Affordable Communities, you can look us up on our website.
I'm joining.
Great.
I'm joining today.
affordablephillycommunities.org.
I love it.
And there's a way you can join, and there is only strength in numbers. We have to be smart
without
with the
question.
Tools, but strength in numbers. Right now, there are 38 groups. I'll stop there.
No, that's fine. That's fine.
Let me just say something.
Go ahead,
Ron. Kenny Gamble wrote a song called People Power. I'm going to get that to you, Nora. It's a great song. Billy Paul sing that song. It's a beautiful song.
We're
People Power.
It.
Absolutely.
It is a very good
right.
song. Let me just jump in here, and I do want to get to some callers. But to you, Carolyn, I mean, should the goal be, if it's possible, to come up with something that everyone can sign in on, racially, economically, and in many ways, ethnically diverse neighborhoods and communities? Should that be the goal, no matter what we're talking about?
Yes, I honestly think that if we are, as a culture, much more enthusiastically seeking diversity in our neighborhoods, we wouldn't have so many of these problems, because we wouldn't have the prevailing assumption that neighborhoods inevitably push toward a homogeneous, a kind of sameness about the population. If we were much more accepting of diversity in our neighborhoods, people wouldn't be acting on that assumption. And that would solve a lot of these problems, because the marketplace is a marketplace which responds to people's assumptions about what's going on in their neighborhood around them and when they have to leave and where they can find a bargain.
So if we value then diversity as much as we value increasing property values, that might get us closer. Raheem, and then we'll get to Meredith.
Well, I think that it's just, you know, a big lie. I don't believe that. And I've seen no evidence in America where this diversity, I think there's a diversity when it's economics. When you get to a certain level economically, then it doesn't matter what, if you are, you know, polka dot, it don't make a difference. Then you can live, as long as you live and you uphold the laws and the mores of that neighborhood, then you're fine. But for the most part, black people want to live with black people, brown people want to live with brown people, white people want to live with white people.
Raheem, I invite you to Germantown, well, the neighborhood where Nora and I both live.
Well, Germantown is, I know Germantown very well. And there are pockets of Germantown where it's 100% black. There's pockets of Germantown where there's kind of a mixed situation. And I think that's probably the exception. That's not the rule. The rule is that people want to live around themselves. And there's nothing wrong with that. The Jewish community lives around the Jewish community. The Polish live around the Polish. The Italians live around the Italians. The Irish live around the Irish. The Chinese live with the Chinese. You know, it's nothing wrong with that, and it's nothing wrong to accept that. It seems like it becomes a very big issue when black people and white people start talking to each other as if this doesn't exist already. And so that's a major problem. It's a very ignorant approach that I think many of us have, and a dream that many have had, but it's not our reality.
Well, and we could do a whole hour on this back and forth that we have. Let me first, though, get Meredith from Chestnut Hill to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Meredith. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Well, now, I've just been really upset by what Raheem said, because here in Chestnut Hill, we don't have black people living with black people and white people living with white people and green people living with green people. The neighborhood that I live in, and I grew up in Chestnut Hill, although I was away for a few years, and back then, of course, that was a different story in the 30s and 40s. It was when Albert Greenfield moved in, he was Jewish, and everybody had a fit. It turned out that he was a great neighbor, and a lot of other interesting people and good people moved into the area. And where the street where I live, in an apartment, there are a lot of Asians, there are a lot of people of color, there are Latinos, there are people like me, Anglo-Saxon white. But it's a matter of culture. It's not a matter of money.
Fair enough. Meredith, thanks for calling
again. Everybody
in.
Just wants to talk about the exceptions, but they don't talk about, that's the majority of Philadelphia. You know, I know Chestnut Hill very well. I know Germantown very well. And I've been around for almost 60 years. And I know those neighborhoods very well. And so if you can afford to live in Chestnut Hill, you're free to do it. But again, most of the city is racially segregated. And that's just the bottom line. And to think that it's not is just... It's just the facts, and I'll get Nora, who's been bringing all the facts. Nora, you got to bring us the facts, so you can dispute what I'm saying, but I'll go by the facts, and I'm going by what I see in my mind's eye and what I've traveled across the city of Philadelphia.
Anything you want to do, weigh in on that, Nora, then we'll get back to our callers.
Yeah. Because Nora got the facts, though.
But this is not about facts. I think this is about values and where you feel comfortable. And I guess I'm in between on these positions. I personally believe that I want to live in a neighborhood where there's diversity. And to me, that is about money. It's about race and ethnicity. It's about, you know, people who I can learn from, that I want to learn from. But I believe that strong communities are communities that are organized, and that many times people point to the fact that poor people need to live near rich people in order to learn something, or people of color, especially black people, need to live near white people in order to learn something or to be good, the strongest community. I do not believe that. I think if you've organized your community so that people understand that all communities need services, more communities shouldn't get, some communities shouldn't get all of them and us get none, that will make a really big difference. But I really want to live in a place that's diverse.
Let me get Imani from West Philadelphia to join us. Imani, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. How
Good morning.
Are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
Good.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to talk about gentrification in my neighborhood. I live in West Philadelphia, which is slowly University City is creeping further and further back towards like 60th Street. And in my neighborhood, I find that gentrification doesn't benefit the people who've been living here. I've been living in my house for almost 30 years, for about 28 years, and I was fortunate to have parents who focused on education and, you know, made that important in our life, so we're pretty stable in our home. But there's a lot of people who, you know, are living paycheck to paycheck and, you know, are struggling in this neighborhood. So recently, our taxes have been raised by $500, which has, you know, hurt a lot of families in our neighborhood, and I just find that the things that gentrification brings into our neighborhood doesn't help us. So, for example, there's a co-op that's just been built around the corner from our house, and it's a nice place, but you have to pay to be a member. And if you're not a member, you pay really inflated prices. For example, I think it was like $3 or $4 for one green pepper. Now, there's people who live around here where $10 make or break your life. $10 is if you're going to be able to buy a loaf of bread for your family. But they're paying an additional $500 in taxes, and now they can't afford to go to this nice co-op that doesn't benefit us. Well, the neighborhood schools in my area are Huey and Reed. They're, you know, they've been going downhill. But the people that come and move in, they send their kids out to private school and charter school out of the area. So them being here doesn't benefit us.
Well, Imani, I do appreciate the call to Radio Times. Looks like Carolyn Adams wants to respond to your call. This is a story.
Yes, and it's a fairly common story, actually, in Philadelphia now. What Imani is pointing out, I think, is that some of our major institutions like universities and like hospitals and major cultural institutions are increasingly concerned about improving the neighborhood immediately adjacent to their facility. They want that place upgraded, so to speak, in a way that will welcome customers, will welcome patients, will welcome college students, visitors to their enterprise.
And
so they've put a lot
and
of
staff, right?
Yes, and staff. Mm-hmm. And they've put a lot of effort into investment in the immediately surrounding neighborhood. But that has some advantages, particularly with respect to security, because so many of these institutions actually run security services that go beyond their own campuses. But it also creates the kind of a differentiation in the neighborhood that Imani is commenting on.
The kind of town gown, we call it. Let me get another caller. This is Jean from Strawberry Mansion. That's in West Philadelphia. Jean, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I was wondering if, you know, if your guests might comment on maybe if they know if gentrification brings unscrupulous developers into an area, maybe that vandalize properties to accelerate vacancies and flight. I knew you were talking about white flight and black flight. I'm in North Philadelphia, and I own a house, and I've had a problem with vandalism as I tried to upgrade property. So I was wondering if you'd comment on that.
I mean, Gene, you're saying you think that speculators might be doing the vandalism in order to get people like you to leave and then get your house?
Right. Because I bought into an area to improve the property and kind of bring it up. And as I'm bringing the property up, you know, there's ongoing vandalism. So I was wondering if that's a general condition or situation in the city.
Yeah, I don't. Well, let me see what Raheem says.
I don't think it might be an isolated situation. It would be hard to believe that somebody is orchestrating some really
criminal kind of, activity,
isn't it? But it seemed
Right.
But I think, you know, here's the thing that I think that you know, we're talking and, you know, having this conversation, but there's no real quick answer to this issue. This is a very, very complicated situation, and so You know, you can have isolated situation like the woman who called, who was proud of her neighborhood, her street in Chestnut Hill, and she should be. And Nora, your comment, it was right on. I mean, I'm for diversity as well. I love a diverse neighborhood. I also like to see a very strong black neighborhood. I like to see our people, black people, move in this country and in this city past the level of near poverty, poverty near poverty, or working poor, to get more into the middle class and the higher income. I'd like to see more blacks and entrepreneurs. So there's a lot of issues that, that are in the way, big barriers in the way. And many of them, and we're talking about them, but they're structural in nature.
Well, and just to throw something else out, and then I do want to get to Amanda from Port Richmond, is oftentimes, Carolyn, a house is a family's main asset.
Absolutely. And honestly, that has worked against one of the standard strategies that you sometimes hear put forward in theoretical discussions, and that is that we should create for affordable housing through creating trusts and co-ops and nonprofit kinds of ownership schemes that would allow rents to remain affordable. Well, that's all to the good. But what it does also produce is that it eliminates the opportunity for people to accumulate the asset as part of their family's wealth. And we have a huge asset gap in this country.
Hold on, Nora. Let me get Amanda from Port Richmond to join us. Amanda, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I have a unique perspective because I'm self-employed. So I am working class poor, but I've seen my income go up in the last 10 years more than it would have if I worked for somebody else. So I see the pros and the cons of gentrification, and I both enjoy and feel like it's a part of my responsibility to offer solutions. And one of the things I notice is that gentrification is a burden to municipal waste. So I think of things like a luxury tax for, you know, buying things online, not necessarily food and clothing. But, you know, a city like Philadelphia should force people to pay a tax to the city when they purchase online. The packaging and the trash that is from, you know, higher income people coming in and gentrifying the environment, it's a huge burden to all of us. You really can't afford to shop online. Many of us are just living on income so low that, you know, that's not our lifestyle, and we shouldn't subsidize people coming into the city who are already benefiting from their mobility that we don't have.
Well, Amanda, let me just jump in here, because we're almost out of time here. I mean, should we sort of pit residents here against people coming into the city who want to live here?
Well, I really appreciate the question of how do we address it and what resources are coming in to address it, but in my case, in the neighborhood where I work, we really want to welcome new residents, and what's a way to do that and make sure that they take responsibility for the fact that they are new and that there are folks who have been here for years who have created a really strong neighborhood just the way the caller has.
Well, and what I hear in the caller is that there, and we're almost out of time here, to you, Carolyn, which is that there have to be other ways for the city to think about ways of getting money into the city. I mean, we are very property or more wage tax centric, I think, than we are property, although probably property owners don't feel that way.
Well, yes, we complain nonstop about property taxes, but actually our property taxes are low relative to other cities only because we depend so heavily on the wage tax. But I'm going to go back to what I said earlier in the hour, which is I think our best solutions are solutions which generate resources for affordable housing out of the natural operation of the marketplace. Because I think Philadelphia really does need to continue to develop. We need people to be coming to the city of Philadelphia. We have massive vacancy and abandonment in the city. And so we have a lot of housing in neighborhoods that we want to get people to come to. We aren't going, and we support our municipal services, which are so important, especially our schools. So we need more development.
Well, we could go on. Just feel like we scratched the surface of this conversation. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Carolyn Adams, professor in the Department of Geography and Urban Studies at Temple University, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Raheem Islam, president and CEO of Universal Companies, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And Nora Lichtash is executive director of the Women's Community Revitalization Project, also a member of the Philadelphia Coalition for Affordable Communities Steering Committee. And Nora, thank you for joining us as well.
I'm proud to be on the radio.
Well, we're proud to have you on the radio. We love radio here at Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. Looks like we got a whole conversation started offline, and that can be carried on. In fact, probably go to our Facebook page and check it out. I'm Marty Moscone. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.